Welcome to episode 23. I got Wesley Saunders here next to me. You're going to meet this man in just a second. Forged by Fire, let me tell you what it's all about. There's a lot of podcasts out there that provide great business content, great inspirational content. What I want to do is something a little bit different. I wanted to talk about people's stories that just right after they made it, that fall back down, and what you go through, what you feel like, what that fire is. And a lot of people don't make it out of that fire, and some people are forged by it. So they make it, they fall, and they come back up and they rise again, kind of like that phoenix rising from the ash. And that's the context of Forged by Fire. My backstory, from Michigan originally, very blue collar, middle class upbringing, got introduced to entrepreneurship at 18, made my first million at 25. Company I was a part of went out of business, fire. I bought the assets, created another company, ran it to 40 million a year in sales. 2009 hit, it crashed to 12 million in sales, fire. Pivoted, launched the Body by Volume 90 Day Challenge, ran it to a couple billion in sales, and lost that too, fire. So the bottom line is business is all about entrepreneurship, and life is all about those peaks and those valleys. And this podcast is about how do we get out of those valleys to make another run. So episode 23, we have my brother Wesley here. This is the best dressed anyone's ever showed up. He came straight from Tulum.
Hey, I'm here.
Straight from Tulum, showed up looking good, bro. Looking good.
Thank you, man. I appreciate it. I feel wonderful, man. This is the new conscious cloths, right? That's what everybody's rocking now.
Bohemian chic.
Hey, I like that.
Now, I can play in the hat game. I haven't gone to this yet. Kimona?
Yeah. Something like that. It's a mix between a kimono and a dashiki. So,
you know. Dashiki?
Yeah.
All right.
Yes, sir.
Don't mix up those two words in one sentence.
I won't. Not at all. Not at all, man. But thank you for having me, brother.
So happy you're here. So let's go through your backstory. Take your time with it. You know, kind of tell everyone really quickly who you are and maybe even just a little bit of like, I don't know, the Reader's Digest version. And then we're going to go deep into the story.
Okay. It's always interesting when somebody asks you to give a synopsis of your life, right? Like, Where do you start? Where do you finish? But, you know, my story started in Gary, Indiana, right? A Midwest kid myself as well. So I know about those harsh winters, right?
That's Grand Rapids.
There you go.
90 minutes away.
Right up the road, man. And so, yeah, Lake Michigan ain't nothing to play with in the winter. But, so Gary, Indiana is where I was birthed. And
murder capital of the world for a little while.
For a little while. And it's a shame that we took pride in that aspect, right? Like, that was a badge of honor for a while. And that just gives you the thinking and dichotomy of what's going on there. But obviously, you know, at that time, early 90s wasn't a great place to grow up if you could help it. So, you know, I ended up moving to North Carolina with my father. He got a great job with the Raleigh News and Observer, a very prominent newspaper in the Raleigh-Durham area. And so I was between Indiana and Durham, North Carolina half the year. And so my parents had split custody of me. Which was great. I tell people all the time, man, it was the best thing that ever happened to me, my parents not being married, because I was able to watch a couple people learn how to co-parent with one another and make me the priority, right? And so, you know, grew up pretty
That's
cool.
That's great parenting.
That's great parenting,
I
man.
Have to co-parent. It's because we've been through so much growth and development, it's easy for us, but you can't imagine how many people, both sides of couples, ask how we do it. It's
yeah. like... It's an art. It's definitely an art. It takes two to tango. And
your parents handled that well.
Handled it well. And I think, you know, them not being married, you know, might have added to the success of that, you know. So,
well, if you take two people that are unhappy being married and you separate them and they can be happy, that should be at the benefit of the kids.
It should be. But that's not always how it happens, is it? So, you know, I'm being 34 now, I'm able to look back on it and see where the benefits, you know, happen, because I know a lot of friends whose life was crushed after their parents got divorced when they were 12 or 13, right? And so you go through those instances where I didn't have a lot of childhood trauma. I see a lot of guys, you know, and men and women who are older in age still dealing with things they never recuperated from in childhood.
That's great to hear. So I'm very fortunate in the same regard. I can't relate or connect to people that speak of the scenarios and some of the tragedies that they've been through. It's just like, it's mind-boggling to me. Yeah. So it's like, shout out to both of our parents.
There you go. Hey, shout out, folks. Mom, pops, thank you.
You raised good kids.
Right, yeah. Life is already hard enough without adding some stresses to some kids growing up, right?
Yeah. So you got to North Carolina. How old were you when you moved out there?
I was 6 years old, but you know, they still had split custody. Yeah, I was pretty young, but you know, I was still back and forth every year, so 6 and 6, and so we made it work. I'm flying at an early age, right?
So mom stayed in Gary.
Mom was still in Gary. Yeah, she was up there. So 7 years old, I'm flying out of O'Hare Airport, you know, by myself sometimes. So I had to grow up quick, but it was great, you know.
And this is where anyone could just walk to the gate.
That was it. Your mom walked me to the gate, she'd be gone, and you know, she'd be off somewhere. So you know, that you know, helped me grow up, and I was able to, you know, realize how things work at an early age. And of course, I was bigger than all the kids, right? So sports was a very prominent part of my life growing up, especially in North Carolina. You know, Midwest is all about basketball. But, you know, we get down to North Carolina and the football thing is pretty prominent. And, you know, me being bigger than everybody, I wanted to play. But I ran into
water polo?
Water polo.
Horse jockey.
Yeah. You know what time it is.
Horse jockey.
Come on, man.
I love it.
So, you know, that was interesting, starting that in NC and really getting my footing there. But, I guess one of the traumas that I could talk about is, you know, being bigger than all the other kids because I wasn't able to play football at age 7 and 8 with kids my age because I was too big. And so they had a weight limit, weight requirement. And so that forced me to play soccer. And I was in gymnastics
for five years.
Yeah. I played soccer and gymnastics for 5 years.
Why didn't they just move you up to like the older age bracket?
Well, it would have been two age brackets above. And my dad, and I was 7 years old playing with some 10, 11 years old. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, but that was usually the route a lot of big kids took. And so shout out to my father for taking a stand and saying, you know what? No, we're not going to go that route.
Yeah.
Let a kid be a kid. We'll get you know, great and other stuff. Cause my dad's an intellectual anyway. It was all about school. You know, he really couldn't care less about sports. And so that was an aspect where I had to learn, okay, let's pivot. What else can I do? And so soccer and gymnastics really helped me grow.
I've seen you do some backflips.
There you go. Yeah, the backflip started.
You challenged my daughter when she was 8 to do her back handspring.
She beat me for the record, but you know, hey, look, it was good challenge.
Not at all. And if you've never seen a 6'6", 6'7"?
6'7".
6'7", and 260?
265, yeah, right on.
6'7", 265, man, do a backflip, just standing backflip. It's something to see. It's an art.
There you go, man. I've always prided myself on being able to do things that people wouldn't expect me to do, you know, and that always felt good to me, which was, you know, why I partook in those things at an early age and, you know, and got into writing. My father's a prominent journalist in North Carolina, like I said. So, you know, really understanding reading and why it's fundamental and literature and things of that nature really helped me understand sports better, helped me understand, you know, schooling and things like that. So my upbringing was pretty cool, you know, growing my stature.
You still write?
Oh, of course, all the time. Yeah.
What type of writing do you prefer?
You know, whatever comes to me. Sometimes, you know, for a while it was poetry growing up. I thought that was a big thing. And then it was short stories and, you know, fictional writing. But now, obviously, at 34, nonfiction is probably more interesting than anything. Okay. My autobiography is going to blow the books off. So I'm looking forward to that. But yeah, I'm definitely stick with the writing. And it's meditative. I know you know.
I read a lot of poetry. Yeah.
Do you? Okay. Yeah, so you know how healing that can be. So, you know, thank goodness I was into that. But yeah, growing up, you know, it was cool. Graduated from Durham Riverside High School and with a bunch of offers to play college football and basketball. A lot of people don't know I was better at basketball than football.
Okay.
So that was one of my big tough decisions.
You liked football better.
I wouldn't even say that. I think I like basketball better, man. But, you know, I was thinking in the future. I was a lazy kid. I was pretty big and lazy. I was like, look, you know, I'm probably going to have a better chance to make it to the NFL from a numbers standpoint. So I'll stick with the place where I probably, you know, pose a better threat from a mismatch standpoint. So football was it. Coach Steve Spurrier came into town and, you know, was talking some good stuff amongst all the coaches that we had coming in across the country. I was like, you know what, South Carolina, right up the road, not too far. You know, up and coming program. So that's what we stuck with. And yeah, that's where I got my collegiate career started.
Tell me what Spurrier's
like. Oh, the old ball coach. All right now, Wes. Yeah. He was the old ball coach, man. He was a character, I tell you that for sure. But he was a straight shooter. And he was one of those guys where, you know, if you could play ball, he was gonna put you on the field. And I respected that. So, you know, that was one of the reasons why I committed to the University of South Carolina. And, you know, he showed me all these big TV deals that USC had just signed and CBS, and we'll be playing on TV all through the year. I said, this is interesting. You know, I want to play up against the best to prove I'm the best.
Yeah.
And so that's what we did. And we went up the road, and it was a great decision for a while. You know, I get there and my story continues on, and I have a great few years at USC and become the number one tight end in the country one point, man. And it was, you know, it was a pretty big deal to see all of my dreams right there within grasp, you know, after all of that hard work and everything that we put in to get there. But of course, there comes the fire, right? Which is why we're here to, what we're here to talk about, man. Cause you know, all stories aren't just, you know, cotton candy and unicorns, right?
Well, I mean, in any story that's interesting definitely is not.
There you go.
Any story of triumph, any story of success is, it's got, that's definitely not cotton candy and unicorns.
Yeah.
So, well, let's dive into that part of the story. So you have a great collegiate career, you know, one of the top tight ends in the country. And what happens next? Who do you end up playing for next?
Well, before I get there, man, my senior year, I get suspended by the NCAA for accepting impermissible benefits from boosters and agents, you know, basically taking money and accepting funds for my likeness.
The law that's now in the trash can.
There you go.
Kind of like, you know, it's kind of like people that went to jail for cannabis, and now it's like, you know, the rich bankers are own the large cannabis companies.
Precisely.
The law that now has changed so that athletes can get paid, so that people are not taking advantage of their name and likeness.
Yep.
Well, I actually didn't know this part of the story, so go deeper. Take it away.
Yeah, thank you, man. Yeah, well, you know, that's kind of, at that point, you know, if you were anywhere related to sports, you knew that the better you were in collegiate sports, the better opportunity you had to get a couple handshakes to get a little extra money in your pocket because, you know, they quote unquote pay us with an education, right? And so, you know, you got all these college athletes who are making millions of dollars for the university, and we're going home with maybe $40 a weekend. That was our weekend money. It was
right.
A $40 stipend, which could be deducted if you miss a class or you miss a meal. You could walk home with $12, right? And for the whole weekend, that's gas, that's everything. And so the idea was that, okay, well, you get good at sports, you'll be able to get a couple handshakes and people to look out for you before you go to the next level. And that's what happened with me, man. I was enjoying myself. I'm in college having a great time, and I'm getting better at football, and people are noticing. And that's what happened. When people notice, the good and the bad notice. So, you know, around 2010, I'm getting attention from agents and boosters and everybody who knows. Maybe, you know, I got a first round projection from Mel Kiper, and they, you know, automatically that's a $15 million signing. But people start looking at the numbers, right? So you got these financial advisors who know much more about business than I do, and they're preying on kids who are about to come out, right? I was preyed upon. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. But I should have had more knowledge about what I was getting into. I had some very prominent people in my corner who were trying to warn me about these things. My uncle, Butch Williams out of North Carolina, who was my agent as well, you know, great guy who was able to warn me about things that were coming. And as a kid, you kind of sometimes ignore that stuff, man. We saw somebody coming at you with a bag of cash, and we were, you know, they were flying me up to the Hamptons and, you know, down to Miami and all of these places from Columbia, South Carolina, you know. So obviously, you know, it was a great time. It's hard to pass up, but it ended up coming back to bite me in the butt. When the NCAA came to town and had racked up all of this information on me from traveling. This was a time where Twitter had just gotten big, right? Twitter. So all of a sudden I'm posting pictures from spring break down in Miami at these luxurious hotels. And, you know, people are like, wait, how's this guy paying for this? I only got $40 technically. How'd you get there? You know, you got new chains and all of this. But, you know, my peers, they love seeing it. So I was feeding into, oh, man, Wes, you're having a great time down there. We want to see more. And the more I was posting, the more they were watching. And eventually, that summer before my senior year, the NCAA came knocking like the FBI with a big book of stuff and, you know, came and got me off the field and told me I was under investigation with a couple of friends from University of North Carolina. And it was one of the biggest, it was actually up to date, the largest NCAA investigation in history after Reggie Bush's situation comes in second. So, yeah, man,
what percentage of, we'll call it D1 football players, at that time, do you think we're getting outside support of any sort?
Oh, man. I would say, being generous, maybe 70%. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. I thought you were going to say 50.
No. It's definitely pretty high, whether it comes from, you know, alumni who's in the city or, you know, big, you know, depending on how big your name is, you could be getting some, you know, handshakes from anybody. But, you know, obviously now that's the thing that's a selling point for kids, right? How much money can I get in which situation, which is awesome for them.
So this connects the dot for me as to why you went undrafted.
Yes. There you go.
So you was it right before your senior year, or was it, it was so right. You finished your junior year season?
Yeah.
You're ranked as one of the top tight ends in the country headed into senior year. I understand.
Yes.
What do you remember mentally? What transpired for you mentally when NCAA walked in?
It was panic. I remember not being prepared at all, and it was pretty much like I remember people asking, "Where's the body buried?" Because you know they came in, and you would have thought I killed someone, man. It was pretty intense. They checked phone records, they checked bank statements. I didn't even know they could check all the stuff that they checked, and so you know I was totally ill prepared. I should, you know,
did you sign a contract that allows them to do that when you're a football player?
I guess you being a part of the NCAA as a collegiate athlete, you administer to their rules.
There's probably somewhere in paperwork that you guys actually sign off.
There you go. It's 1,000 bylaws. Yeah, it's 1,000 of them. You spend your first couple of days.
I agree to be a D1 athlete, NCAA, and you're agreeing to all that shit.
Yes, exactly. Wow. Yeah. So it's under contract.
Junior college baseball. You know, we don't have these problems.
Which poses the question, why guys, you know, we're fighting so much to be considered an employee, right? If we got to sign all these laws, you know, like as if we're an employee, then we should be treated as such. But I just remember a lot of, you know, I was depressed. Mm-hmm. It was a summer, man, and, you know, things went from, literally, you go from, I'm about to, because, you know, also, my body was in the best shape ever. I was going to kill it that year. You know, I was ready. This was going to be my year. We had a great team coming up. And, you know, they suspended me right before the season started and dismissed me from the team. I was like the sacrificial lamb. I think the NCAA offered the school a proposition, get rid of Wes, and we'll make sure everything else goes away. Because I don't know if you know this, but when the NCAA comes to town for one player, they then have the right to investigate the rest of the athletic program. So now the baseball team and the equestrian, everybody's under fire, and their books are having to be opened because of this one guy. And, you know,
this is nuts.
Yeah, yeah. It was a lot of money involved, man. The city, yeah, it was a big deal in the state, you know, because obviously, you know, that's unwarranted attention that you don't really.
This is such an interesting conversation for me. And I'm actually really glad that you surprised me with this part of the convo, because, you know, I've had exposure to celebrities, athletes, and just had a lot of behind the scenes conversations and, you know, and conversations in public or whatever about lots of topics.
Yeah.
But I've never been in a one-on-one conversation with somebody that had to take on the NCAA. Besides Coach Dale Brown, but as a coach, and we ended up beating that, and there's a whole documentary on it. We actually funded the documentary.
Oh, wow.
But I've never with a player. So this is actually really interesting. Okay, so how long is the investigation period? Like, what was the scariest moments? What's some of the shit they put you through? Take me through kind of that NCAA investigation.
Oh, yeah. It started during the summer. They collected a bunch of evidence. I was actually in the Hamptons on a trip that was deemed illegal when we got the call that, hey, you're going to be investigated.
$40 can take you to the Hamptons.
Yeah, they're going to be investigating you on Tuesday. And so the irony is that I was up there with a financial advisor who was a former lawyer, and he had a bunch of, you know, these big wig lawyer friends who all lived in the Hamptons. So immediately we take a limo from Manhattan back to the Hamptons to a friend of his house, and we devise a plan on what we're going to say to the NCAA. It was like, you know, a scene out of a movie. We're on the beach, and you're like, don't talk to anybody, don't say anything until you get there. It got super intense immediately, right? And so I called a couple of my buddies who were also being investigated from North Carolina. You know, they didn't know what to expect. Nobody kind of knew what to expect. And they came in with a full blitz. And from what I know now, when the NCAA comes knocking, they already got everything they need to know.
Of course.
And so they're just waiting on you to tell them.
It's
right?
Like the IRS.
Just like the IRS. They know everything. And they're waiting on you to give them what they want. And unfortunately, you know, I panicked. And I wasn't truthful and forthcoming, which is a bylaw. And once you violate that bylaw, you can be reprimanded with suspension or loss of your, you know, amateur status. And that's exactly what happened. You know, they blindsided me a couple of times. You know, I actually had a right to have a lawyer there. But in my mind, I thought having a lawyer would make me look guilty. And so they came and surprised me got me off the field one day. They weren't supposed to come for 2 days later. They came 48 hours early. They caught me off guard. I didn't have time to get my lawyer down there. And I was totally unprepared, man. I mean, they had me in a room with the light. It was like out of a movie, man. You know, you got the light shining. I'm sweating.
It's so stupid when you think contextually. When you're just like, if you go macro perspective and you say, okay, all of this money that's put into this witch hunt of all these athletes back then, all of this time and energy and effort, because why? Because an organization is maximizing their talent and their brand, making billions of dollars to give them $40 in the weekend. And they're going to treat it like you said, like there's a murder. Like, who did you murder?
Yeah.
It was intense. No, I just went to Miami.
And I'm 21 years old, you know, so technically I'm a kid. Now when I look at it, you know, you don't know what you don't know. And I was like, I'm a kid, man. You know, there has to be some level of understanding if you're saying that I'm an amateur, that, you know.
We could go down, and I'm sure you'd be the first in line to go down this rabbit hole of, it's just pure exploitation. It's just pure exploitation. Bottom line, right? It's like taking advantage of young athletes, maximizing their dollars, giving the talent as little as possible. Minimum wage for the best. You're the best performers in the country, but we're going to pay you as minimum performers. It's fucking ridiculous. It's insane. Now, the other side of me, that's the very pragmatic side says, but hey, rules are rules, and we got to follow the rules, and the rules are the same for everybody. If the rules are the same for everybody, then we got to follow them. But that doesn't mean the rule's not absolutely idiotic.
Mm-hmm.
And it's clearly was built for exploitation of young, talented athletes so that this organization could make billions of dollars and not have to pay them shit.
There you go. That's that sums it up. And you know, a guy like me, I'm
media jerk.
Hey, look. I'm an observer. I observe things. And so even when I get to school and I see that the coaches have these deals with, you know, local dealerships where they get free cars, and these dealerships will swap out the cars before 5,000 miles so they could sell them as new on the dealership lot. And so the coaches are riding in style. They got all these different perks at country clubs, and they're living great. They're making some 6-7 figures. And here we are with these $42 every week, and I'm driving to campus with my 1988 Jeep Grand Wagoneer with the wood paneling chipping off the side, man. And it was, you know, people made fun of my car, and I'm watching this, and I'm like, okay, well, all right, well, at least if I get myself to be a good athlete and, you know, prominent enough on the field, then I'll be able to partake in some of this glory. So that's what you're kind of working towards, and then you get there. And unfortunately, you know, we got caught at the wrong time. They were on a witch hunt from the Reggie Bush case. You know, a lot of people would say, hey, you need to be harder on these athletes. How can you let this happen? You need to do more.
Mark my words, with how hard college is suffering right now of kids not wanting to go, and the fact that this conversation about paying athletes is being upended. The NCAA is on its
their days are numbered. Their days are numbered.
Days are numbered. Because if you're the fucking best actress in the world at 5 years old, you get paid as the best actress, as a child actress or child actor. If you're the best tennis player at 12, you're worth $50 million, right? If you're the best fill in the blank at anything else, you get paid as the best. But the fact that if you're the best athlete in the country, but you happen to sign your life away, the NCAA means they can take all the money. I'm so glad. I'm so glad that it's finally going to be coming to an end. And I know one person is probably more glad than anyone's, Coach Dale Brown. I know that
there
guy.
You go.
I know that guy well. So thank you for sharing this part of the story, man.
Oh, yeah. This is definitely part of the testimony. And, you know, once you put the dots together, you know, most of my quote-unquote fire came within a three-year span, right?
Let's go to year two.
2010, I'm suspended. Yeah, so that's where everything leads into, man. So, you know,
Let's go to year two of that fire. So you go undrafted. Who picks you up?
Well, before I go undrafted, you know, I have to sit out. I'm still in school during the season. So now I'm – right. So exactly, right? So I'm out of school, but I have to watch these guys play. You know, my teammates do have the best season in school history. I don't know if that's the year that Cam Newton came out. South Carolina makes it to the SEC championship, right? And so I'm on camp. We beat Alabama. And it was just having to deal with that all season. But right before the season, my old teammate, Kenny McKinley, committed suicide. He played for the Denver Broncos.
Very sorry for that.
And, you know, me feeling sorry for myself, obviously, you know, not being on the field. My livelihood has been taken away now. You know, felt deserted. And then we get the news about Kenny. That's like, it's August, September, so beginning of the season. So, you know, I immediately, you know, look internally and realize, okay, well, you know, the situation is not as bad. Like, I'm not... Am I suicidal? I'm not. I don't think I'm suicidal. I don't want to take my life, right? So it made me put things in perspective. So bless his soul, man. But you know, dealing with that made me look at things totally differently. Okay. You know, I finished school. That's that for the rest of the year. The guys make it to the SEC championship. I'm happy for them. And then, you know, according to my agent and a couple people, you know, I was still pretty pretty high on the draft board, right? If you think about it in retrospect, I go through a season, I don't get hurt. I'm still the same player. So potentially, you know, a team could be willing to take a chance on me late first round or second round. So we get some interest from Nike and, you know, I become a Nike athlete. I leave school in January, leave South Carolina behind. And I'm out of here, and I'm off to Dallas, Texas to train at the Michael Johnson Performance Facility that's sponsored by Nike and former Olympic gold medalist Michael Johnson. So, you know, we had a great time down there in Dallas, and, you know, that's where I was going to start my training, and it's time to move on to the next step of the NFL. I was there for a week, and I was training with Michael Irvin from the Cowboys, showing me a few moves and how to – you know, do some things on the field, and I wanted to stay extra and do some extra work because now all of a sudden, Nick,
he's a trip. I ran into him at a nightclub in Dallas one time.
That's how all great stories start. I met Michael Irvin in a nightclub.
They're bringing me and my best friend through the kitchen, and they want to take us basically VIP entrance to the other side. And he's walking past the other direction with a different, you know, bouncer and security guard, and he's like, "Yo, bro." Yo, bro, I love that shirt, bro.
Sounds about right.
He's like 55 in Dallas.
Mike still gets it. Hey, look, he's a legend. I heard about those stories in Dallas, man. Yeah. You can't walk around Dallas without hearing about those Michael Irvin stories.
He was fun. We ended up hanging out with him later. He's fun.
Yeah, good guy, man. Good guy. He was showing me some things. And like I said, you know, now after missing a season, it's a little more pressure on me to perform at the NFL Combine. Now I've got to
prove something. I've got to
overshow how good of an athlete I am.
He just had a bad day. Look what he did last week. This is like,
he missed a year of football.
Maybe people can't say, do it anymore.
There you go. Does he even know how to play football anymore? Yeah. Right? It's like that all of a sudden becomes an issue. So I put a lot of stress on myself, a lot of pressure to perform, and unfortunately, I ended up breaking my foot, man. Broke my foot a week into training down there in Dallas, and you know, a month away from the combine where I'm supposed to show my athletic prowess, and now I have this broken bone in my foot. So, you know, dealing with that put me really in a dark place, but, you know, I still had to go to the combine. I still had to do stuff, so I didn't tell anyone. I went to the NFL combine that February and didn't tell anybody about my broken foot. Thought I could skip past, you know, maybe if I could take enough ibuprofen, I'd be all right and still do well. But unfortunately, I had to take some x-rays. Some teams, you know, asked for some x-rays. And so by day two of the NFL combine, you know, guys are asking, you know, some teams are asking, hey, you know, you got a broken bone in your foot here. We saw your x-ray. I'm like, really? What? Who would have thunk it? But, you know,
how bad did it hurt?
It was excruciating.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
It was excruciating. I thought I was going to be able to run the 40-yard dash, but you know, I couldn't even walk on it. I did the vertical jump, vertical leap, broad jump, bench press, and then after that, it just gave out. And, you know, my agent didn't want to go the route of, like, shooting anything in it or doing any, you know, anything on that end. So the ibuprofen didn't work. So long story short, I wasn't able to perform, and you could hear a pin drop in Lucas Oil Stadium when they announced over the loudspeaker that, you know, Wesley Saunders would be not participating in the rest of this combine, you know, due to injury. And you could just look up in the crowd and see all the coaches in there doing, you know, pretty much marking an X. Like, you know, you just missed a year of school and now you're hurt. Like, the hurt might be worse than the suspension, right? Now you're injury prone, right? My first injury ever, really. And so that was a lot to deal with, man. So, you know, now you wonder, people put the pieces together about how a guy like me could go undrafted. Well, a perfect storm can happen and put you in a place where you're crawling out of a space. You don't even know how you got there that quickly. And so all of a sudden, within a year, I go from the number one tight end to I'm not even on people's boards anymore. And so that was very humbling for me. And to leave that combine knowing that, you know, I didn't do anything really to help my case, right? I went there with all these high hopes, and it brought me right back down to reality. Like, will I even make it to the NFL? And shortly after that, they have the draft. I don't get drafted. You know, I still expected to go maybe third or fourth round, maybe fifth. One of my best friends, Colton Palmer, his parents, lovely people down in Durham, North Carolina, they threw a draft party for me, and you know, we invited all these people and friends because surely I'd be going by day two or day three. And day two comes, day three comes, my name is not called, guys who I know I'm better than are selected, and that was the start of the undrafted. And it was a feeling I can't describe to anyone, you know, thinking, you know, having all of your dreams right here within your grasp, and then it just kind of falls by the wayside. So, you know, it woke me up.
I couldn't imagine being surrounded by other people and having to be like, thanks for coming, Like, so glad you were like, what's the awkward energy and awkward conversations and the, thank you for supporting me. Like what's the,
it's so awkward, right? Because everybody else is trying not to be awkward around you. Right. Everybody's like,
they're trying to make sure that you know that they don't notice.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, it's going okay. Well, man, they don't know what they're missing out on.
I didn't watch the last round.
Right. Yeah. We didn't watch. So, but you know, also we got the phone. You got to have your phone line open because you're waiting on a call from a team. So we got the phone sitting on a table by itself. So everybody just kind of, we're trying to have a good time. We're looking at the phone and it doesn't happen. And it's pretty, you know, my parents were there. Everybody's there. You're the hometown hero, and it doesn't happen. And of course, you know, one of my other friends who was involved in the suspension with me, Greg Little from Durham, North Carolina, he went second round. So, you know, we're from the same city. And so, you know, we actually go through the same situation with the suspension. And he kills it at the combine, and he goes second round. So now, you know, my arch nemesis in the city, he went second round, and here I am going undrafted. It was even more embarrassing. But like I said, God, he makes no mistakes. And so that's exactly what I needed to go through at that time. It humbled me. Shortly after that, segue is the NFL lockout, right? So the draft happens, and 2 days later, all NFL operations are halted.
Someone don't want you playing football.
Or they do, because you got to remember, I'm dealing with a broken foot, Nick. So okay. I need, you know, I can't do anything anyway, so I have to get surgery on the foot. And this NFL lockout lasts about 90 days, the exact amount of time it takes for my foot to heal up. It's about a 90-day recovery time after you get this screw. I got a 5-inch screw put in my foot, and because, you know, possibly we'll be ready for training camp.
That's more than just a break. That's a serious injury.
That's a serious injury. It's a pretty serious injury, right? And
you're biomechanical now.
Biomechanical. Yeah. There you go. That's a good way of looking at it, man. And so you got this foreign object in your foot now, and you're trying to train and get back in shape for maybe the NFL to come back, because you don't really know there could be no season technically if talks aren't, you know, gotten together. So, long story short, we get a call from the Steelers and the Ravens right before training camp opens back up, because we hear that negotiations are coming back, and my agent, you know, commits to me going up to Pittsburgh, because I also have to try out for the team now, yeah. Right? As an undrafted free agent, you know, you making the team, you got to earn your spot, and no guaranteed money there. So if you go first or second round, they have to keep you, right? It doesn't matter how terrible you are. I know some terrible first and second round guys. And so you're there just by default, and they have to play you. They got so much money put in you that they have to. On the opposite end, as an undrafted guy, now it's like, you have to do something extraordinary for me to even want to keep you around. Why should I want to keep you, you know? And so it turned into that, and lockout ended, man, and we had about 14 days of training camp. Now everything's condensed. We, you know, no football. There's been no rookie mini camp. There's no nothing. And they just throw you out there right at the end of July and say, okay, guys, football is back, but you got 13 days to make the team. Good luck. And, you know, luckily I went out there, man, had some great.
How many tight ends were you competing against?
About 7 or 8. Okay. Yeah, it was a big room of tight ends.
You were coming in at number 8.
I'm number 8. Yeah, I'm number 8. I saw guys get cut the first day before we even hit the field. They were cutting guys and shuffling them out the building. I'm like, you know, so you do this action. Like, oh, my God. You see guys start to panic. And that's when I get to talk about having to meditate.
Just like, hey, we didn't like the way you looked.
We didn't like the way you looked. Was his jersey too big? Like, now you're trying to figure out what were they looking at to cut this guy? You know, it doesn't make sense. So now I'm like, oh, shit. It was intense, man. And, you know, I had a great talk with my grandma, because, you know, my grandmother, rest her soul at the time, Jaretha Rhines. I was able to talk to her, and her being was so peaceful, you know, because I was panicking. Like, grandma, you know, my foot is hurt. I haven't actually gone full speed in the past 3 months. I've just spent on recovering and healing my foot, so I haven't actually run full speed. And
it's scary.
Now I got to go out there and cut. What if I got to cut to the left? Now I got to cut off this foot that's hurt. And I had all these, you know, I was very anxious. And she just kind of calmed me down, said, "Hey, there's nothing else you can do about it. The Lord is taking care of you. He's gotten you to this point. Now just go out there and do what you do. If you're scared about, you know, making a mistake, then you've already lost the battle." And so I was like, you know, grandma, all right, cool. If I go out there and the thing breaks again and it was meant to be, but if not, I can't go out there scared of that. Right. And so that was the best advice she gave me. And I went out and, you know, I actually almost got cut after the first game. I will say, you know, I was very rusty. It was over a year since I had played football, man. And, you know, Bruce Arians took us over there. We went to Washington and I stunk it up. It was like, you know, it was bad, man. And so, you know, I was like, oh, this, you know, it was fun while it lasted. I could tell people I made it to one preseason game in training camp. But luckily, I think they gave me the benefit of the doubt. I came back, you know, the next couple games and progressively got better, which is what they're looking for in the preseason. And, you know, we played four games within 14 days. And, you know, I got better at each one of them.
Oh, no shit.
Yeah, and I scored a touchdown in the last game. And so, you know, we scored a touchdown to put your name on the map, you know. And we
won
the game.
Good timing the last game.
Very good timing. We were back in my home state of North Carolina in Charlotte playing the Panthers. So my family was there, and I showed out. You know, I did what I was supposed to do. But, of course, nothing's a done deal. So you got to go back to Pittsburgh. You got to wait a couple of days to hear who made the 53-man roster, right? Because, of course, they're going to keep Troy Polamalu. Brent Roethlisberger is on the team, right? Hines Ward, all these big names. So you keep looking down the roster. It's not that much space. You know, it goes from 85 guys to 53. And so
it's 30 guys fighting for three spots.
Basically. And you got and that last day on cut day, 4 p.m. is the cutoff time for cuts. And so you think you had a great preseason. And once again, I'm with my agent. I'm with my people. We're watching the phone. And if you don't get a call, that's the best thing for you. You don't want your phone to ring. Because otherwise, they're calling you to bring in your playbook. It's over for you. Thank you for your time. And long story short, I'm in Pittsburgh hanging out. I actually fell asleep, and you know, because I was so anxious, I just cut off all the lights in the hotel and went to sleep. Like, all right, man, this, you know, it's gonna be over. I wake up, phone's blowing up. I had, you know, 100 missed calls, and I'm thinking, you know, people are calling and telling me, you know, great job, but you know, sorry. And I see that, you know, I had made the 53-man roster. You know, it was a big sigh of relief. Knowing that I, you know, crossed that hurdle, but you know, the journey had just begun at that point, Nick.
Well, first of all, congratulations.
Thank you.
You made it.
Yeah.
You're one of 1%, whatever the data set is, of people that started playing Pop Warner or Little League football that make it all the way and get to say, hey, I made a professional football team.
Yeah.
And you're one of those 1 of 1%.
Thank you. Yeah.
And so you're the Steelers. Who's coaching?
Pittsburgh Steelers, the man himself, Mike Tomlin.
Arians.
Bruce Arians on the offensive side. Yeah, the great Dick LeBeau on defense. You know, these guys, we got all these Super Bowl winners in the locker room, Brett Kiesel and, you know, James Ferrier. Just some great guys. Obviously, Troy Polamalu, who's one of the nicest guys I've ever met in my life. And so, you know, going in the locker room with these older guys who want to see you succeed, but they're also hard on you and they know how to compete. It was the best thing that ever happened to me.
What were some of the lessons that you're going to take from some of that peer group or from the head coaches?
The peer group, man, just, you know, learning how to be a team and learning how to play together, right? Oftentimes when you play sometimes with your brother, you might take it a little easier on him, but they knew how to, what we call iron sharpening iron, right? We knew how to practice together. These guys have been in the Super Bowl a couple of years prior.
Yep.
Actually, the year prior I got there, they were in the Super Bowl. So and they had won it a few years ago. So they knew how to win. They knew how to play under pressure. And that aspect of things really sunk into me. So within, you know, I didn't start off great during the season, but within 3 or 4 games, I was getting into the groove of things. I knew how to practice. I knew how to take care of my body. I'm getting in the cold tub now. I've never been a cold tub kind of guy. But your body starts to, you need something. You got to have something to recover. And so, you know, I'm starting to learn how to take care of my body and do certain things, you know, watch extra film. Right now it's a cerebral game because Bruce Arians had a very tough offense. And so I'm like, oh, man, you got to learn this offense. You can learn his offense. You can learn any offense. Right. So I guess being a student of the game is what I learned from these older guys, you know. And what Coach Tomlin would tell us all the time on film, he was like, hey, don't watch Troy. Troy was one of the laziest practice players you would ever see, right? But he you know, they don't – obviously, he's proven himself on the field, so he doesn't – his practice habits might not –
He knew how to flip the switch.
Yeah, he knew how to flip the switch. Everybody can't flip that switch.
Yeah.
And so that was something I also had to learn. Okay, find your groove. Find your rhythm.
So take me to the final kind of moments of the NFL for you. You were there for a couple of years.
Yeah.
You have some injuries. You – run into some challenges with those injuries and how to counteract that. Walk us through what happens. Take us to the fire.
Well, the fire had started during this whole conversation. So even, I guess, you know, there's two storylines going on at the same time, right? Me trying to make this team as a rookie, as an undrafted free agent, but also me battling injury and pain. So I'm on Vicodin, I'm on hydrocodone, I'm on painkillers that they have been prescribing me from my doctor. And I don't know if you know, that's not the great remedy for going out and performing on the field, right? It kind of makes you drowsy, makes you, you know, not as explosive. So, you know, I'm dealing with that. And I actually had a friend of mine who suggested Adderall. And I will say this, I took an Adderall before a game, man, and got prescribed from my doctor. But didn't know I had to go through the NFL to get it prescribed, which is a whole different subject. But I will tell you, man, it helped me immensely. And, you know, I was able to do some things from a focus standpoint.
Clarity,
man. It was like, you know, my brain was foggy and cloudy. So, you know, I saw what other side there was. Now, I'd only taken it twice. I only took two Adderall. And one of those came right before a drug test. And so I played the whole season, my rookie year, have a great year. We're going into the playoffs. You know, I'm actually doing pretty well. I started 13 games, so I'm starting to get five, you know.
Wow.
Yeah, I scored a touchdown. Amazing. Scored a touchdown on Sunday Night Football. You know, Ben is starting to look at me a little bit more. And things are on the up and up, and we're heading to the playoffs. And we got this great game plan where BA is going to get me the ball more, and we get a letter to the facility saying, you know, Wesley Saunders failed a drug test back in training camp back in August when I just got started. And I'm under threat of a 4-game suspension now. And, you know, it was like, what? Like, four, you know, so you go through the whole year and you think you're doing a great thing. And they tell you, yeah, you failed a drug test back then. We weren't going to say anything, but we're saying something now. So, yeah, here we are. And it's 4-game mandatory, right? They got something called zero tolerance. And so there was really no appealing we could do. They didn't care about my circumstances. They didn't care about the Viking, and they didn't care about any of that other stuff. You took this substance. We didn't approve it. Now you got to pay. And, you know, the coaches had a decision to make, and instead of taking my 4-game suspension then, which would have possibly carried into the playoffs, right? And, right. You know, if we make it to the Super Bowl, I missed the whole playoffs. So we were able to defer the suspension till the next year because we thought we were going to the Super Bowl again, and we ended up losing in the first round to Tim Tebow up in Denver.
Oh, yeah.
which was not expected at all. That was another life lesson. Don't look too far ahead down the road because you got to take care of business right here.
What was the play called?
Miracle in Mile High. Yeah, we went to overtime, man, and we're thinking about New England the next week and Tom Brady and all of this stuff, and we forget about Tebow. And one of my good friends who has his own podcast is doing great, The Pivot, Ryan Clark.
Yeah.
Ryan, he suffers from sickle cell and wasn't able to play that game. And, you know, as a safety, you know, he's the general, back-end general, right? And so I think if he's playing that last play to Demaryius Thomas, rest his soul, I don't think that happens. But, you know, certain things happen, and, you know, we were blindsided, and boom, our, you know, playoff dreams are ended right there in Denver, and which is unfortunate to me because now, you know.
Yeah, you're in the suspension mode.
Right. Now season's over, and I'm going into the offseason. I can't even have a great time because now I'm thinking about this upcoming 4-game suspension that I have to serve for the next 4 games of next year. And, you know.
So in that next season, is that when you move on to Indiana, or is it 2 seasons?
Yeah, that's that next season. That next season coming up, Bruce Arians gets a job in Indianapolis. So he's no longer our offensive coordinator in Pittsburgh. And they bring in a guy by the name of Todd Haley. Now, for whatever reason, I don't think I was Todd Haley's favorite cup of tea. And, you know, you start to understand it's not about
it. But you're my favorite cup of tea.
Hey, thank you, man. I appreciate it.
Drinking West Juice in
yes.
a cup.
Yes, West Juice tea, baby.
His product.
Ah, yeah, but speaking of tea, man, I wasn't his favorite cup of tea. And you start to learn the corporate side of the business where, you know, if a guy comes in, he usually wants, you know, wants to bring his own guys. And so he's bringing his own people in. And
right.
It's not about how well you perform if there's favoritism. And, you know, I had a great preseason again with Pittsburgh, and actually a dominant preseason. I scored again and, you know, did some things where I thought for sure, even the announcers on my last game said, well, you know, that's why Wesley Saunders is going to be a part of this team because he has that kind of talent and he's going to survive the 4-game suspension because during the 4 games, you got to bring in somebody else to take in my spot and all this right. stuff. So, you know, I served my 4-game suspension. 4 games comes up. I'm coming back to the team, man. It was felt like the longest 4 games of my life, but I'm coming back and it's wonderful. They played Thursday night. I come back on a Friday, and they had a roster exemption, so that means, you know, they would have to cut somebody to bring me back. So, you know, everybody in the building is trying to figure out who they're going to cut before they bring Wes back, and they came and brought me in, and Wes was who they cut. And, you know, it was a beautiful Friday afternoon. I remember Coach Tomlin sat me down, and I hadn't even gotten my seat good yet. And Coach said, well, Wes, you know, we're going to let you go. And I just remember just looking at him, and it was almost like it didn't feel like he actually said that. You know, I was like, what? Yeah, we're going to let you go. You know, appreciate everything you've done, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, he gave me the exit speech. And before I knew it, I was walking out of the office, walking out of the stadium with my bags on the way home. And like, I just got cut. Like, you know, it almost like it couldn't happen. You know, my good friend Antonio Brown at the time, we were all laughing. They thought I was joking. I came out of Coach Tomlin's office, and Mike Wallace and the boys like, hey, Wes, what's up, baby? And I had this dead look on my face, and everybody's face kind of straightened up. I'm like, yeah, I'm out of here, fellas. And it was definitely unbelievable. You know, articles came out like, you know, this makes no sense, because obviously they could have cut me before the suspension.
Right.
So it made no sense to keep me around that long, and then, you know, cut me then. So.
So when you look at those, I heard like three major issues that you went through in 3 years.
Yeah.
Being pulled from your senior year.
Mm-hmm.
Having to bounce out of the tryout.
Yep.
And then being cut in that moment.
Yep.
Which one is the harder of the three?
Oh, man. They all brought their own their own flavor. They were flavor of the month at one point, man. I would probably say the hardest might have been collegiately, you know, getting suspended in college, because you don't know what's next, right? I haven't made it to the NFL.
Right.
Nobody's seen me at that level. So now me getting there, I have to cross another barrier. And so, you know, at least once you're in the league and you get cut, or you know, something happens, you've already got film.
Yep.
People know about you. Yep. Your agent's already done his job. So, you know, chances are.
You just had a great preseason.
I had a great preseason, yeah. So it's like, you know, it's not pure panic mode, but that collegiate aspect where you're like, hey, I haven't even gotten to where I want to go yet. Will I get there? That was probably the most stressful. And that was the moment where I realized I had to have the most faith. You know, my faith grew immensely during these times, because, you know, I turned into a recluse. I was all on my own, man. I didn't want to talk to anyone. I was literally depressed, obviously, you know, and dealing with an injury. A lot of people don't talk about athletes dealing with injury as a form of trauma, right? So now your body's traumatized, but your mind is trying to get back from the injury immediately. That's not what your body's meant to do. Your body's got to, you know, healing. Healing takes it's a process. And so you got to respect that process. And if you don't, you'll end up hurting yourself more, right? You see guys all the time.
What's so? How does your career come to an end over those next 1 to 2 years after Indy?
Bruce Arians leaves and goes to Arizona.
Arizona.
Yeah, and Pep Hamilton comes in from Stanford, Andrew Luck's guy, and then once again, you know, you realize that it's all about who you know, and so I ended up getting another suspension, eight game after that, partying in the offseason. I thought I had made it out of the fire. You know, feeling good about myself. I come down to Miami. I'm having a great time. I've got another year under my belt, more money, and I'm having a great time, and I'm partying with everyone, and the party's on me. And at the time, Molly was a big deal. You know, people were, you know, taking all kind of recreational drugs, and Molly was the big thing, and we were, you know, partaking in that. And guess who has a drug test right after he comes back from Miami partying? And test positive for a performance-enhancing drug, which was Molly.
The performance-enhancer,
once again.
I mean, it could enhance some performance, but yeah. I don't know.
Right, so, you know.
I don't know if it's going to enhance a football field.
There you go. So, you know, once again, I'm in the news and the media looking like an idiot for getting, four-game suspension. Okay, he was a kid. Now you get suspended for the second straight year with another team for eight games, right? And so that aspect of things was like, okay, now it's really over. Now I'm probably out of the league, which doesn't happen, to my surprise. I served my eight-game suspension, and the Colts end up bringing me back, and I finished the season with them, and I'm like, okay, I'm back in the league now and getting ready for the next season after we get bounced out of the playoffs. And, you know, I guess what people don't talk about often is the inglorious exit from spaces, right? There was no big send-off. There was nothing to tell me that my time was coming to an end. Like, everything was on the up and up. It was looking like, you know, I had an opportunity to really do some things. And but at the end of the next preseason, the Colts cut me, and I had a great preseason there. And my dad, you know, would always tell me growing up about Wally Pipp, right, and Lou Gehrig, and, you know, don't get Wally Pipped out here. So I always knew this story. But, you know, it happened to me. I say, you know, kids, don't get Wes Saunders, right, if that makes any sense. But, yeah, I had one of my good friends, Jack Doyle, Indiana guy. They brought, you know, during my eight-game suspension, they brought him in to Indy, because you got to have somebody to fill my place.
Yeah.
And they bring him in. He's a nice, hardworking guy. And when I get back, we're all in the room together. And that next year, they ended up keeping Jack and let me go, right? And so, you know, once you open the door for things like that, you know, it's unfortunate things can happen. I don't have anything against Jack. It's all part of the business.
Yep.
But these are the things that, you know, I had to go through. Even though you might be physically, you know, athletically better than a guy, that's not how it always works. You know, this is a business. This is a corporation, you know, and you know, I realize that these owners like the aesthetics of things. So if you're going to be, you're going to cause any kind of trouble or any kind of negative light on the organization, your days are numbered unless you're that guy. And even sometimes those guys get let go, right? Yep. And so Coach Tomlin used to tell us a great quote, be who you can afford to be. Right. And so sometimes you can mess up and they'll keep you. You know, Tom Brady, they forget about Deflategate. And, you know, sometimes, you know, some things get swept under the rug, but everybody isn't so lucky.
Yeah. Well, man, that's a hell of a story.
Yeah.
That's all within 4 years.
Within three years, actually. So 2010, 2011, 2012. Yeah.
Three and a half, 4 years. Yep. Okay. Holy shit. So you just gave like an entire career, it sounds like, in about a 3.5 year run. Of all these little ups and downs, but all of it inside of what I would consider to be still the fire. You had like this little heartbeat.
I never got out of the fire.
You never got out of it.
Right. I thought I was out.
You had these little like tremors, but then it came back down. So during that 3 to 4 years, so I'm going to walk everyone back through this. You're the best in the country.
Yes.
All of a sudden, you're dealing with NCAA, and you start to get a little heartbeat, and all of a sudden, you break your foot. Start to get a little heartbeat, and all of a sudden, you know, Adderall, sort of get heartbeat all of a sudden.
Cut.
You go to Miami. Miami got you. When you know it's time to move on and this is that chapter for you is done, what are all of the thoughts, feelings? What's the lowest point during this journey? Take us through what people that are watching us go through and their failures in business and their failures in their marriages and their failures as a parent while they're trying to run a company. What were you feeling and what's the depths of it?
That's a good question, man. It's, you know, sometimes we got to get out of our own way. You know, obviously through these stories I talk about, I never put the blame on anyone, right? I had a bad case of self-sabotage for a while, right? I knew better. I could have done better, but, you know, I let certain instances take me out of my character. And me really understanding myself was a pretty important aspect of things, because I was, you know, one of my favorite quotes is I tell people, once you've ruined your reputation, you can live quite freely. And so me going through all of these instances and being publicly humiliated and going through the public embarrassment of things actually helped me along the way to understand who I really am, to bring me to a more spiritual place. Like, hey, there's a power that's higher than these clowns who get on Twitter.
What else can they take, right? So when you think about that journey, took money.
Yeah. Reputation.
Took health.
Yeah, took health.
Loss of reputation, loss of identity as an athlete.
And money. Yeah, like I want you to emphasize that money.
Money?
$350,000 in fines. So, you know, that 4-game plus the 8-game amounted to almost
$400,000. Your signing bonus that you would have had if you had been first rounder. Like when you start to put all these, you know, into light, a lot of people lose one of them. I lost my health. I'm in the fire. I came out. I lost my money. I'm overcoming it. I lost my brand was shot. I overcame it. You dealt with 3 or 4 of those all at the exact same time over the course of a couple of years. And, you know, talk about forging of someone's spirits, forging of just what they can handle, a bulletproof exterior. Like, if you make it out of that, you can take on anything.
Yep.
And you made it out.
Yeah. Yeah. I that's a great way of putting it. But, you know, to answer your question about, like, on the way out, a lot of us are stubborn sometimes, you know, so you don't want to tell yourself that it's over. And so I knew physically I could still play. I did everything under the sun to try to get back in the good graces of the NFL. But, you know, it's definitely a tight club to break into once you're on the outside looking in. And I had to learn that the hard way. You know, I pulled out all kind of gimmicks and branding, marketing to try to get what, you know, Why Not West started, you know, trying to get me back on the field. I played in a couple of secondary leagues, the American Alliance of Football, in 2019, which was pretty good till they ran out of money eight games into the season. So, you know, I had other opportunities, but, you know, once you realize you're running into a brick wall, then it's time to, you know, kind of pivot a little bit. But during this whole time, I started learning about healthy ways of taking care of my body. I started learning about gut health. I went vegan for 1 year and lost 42 pounds. At one point, I was up to 305 pounds due to stress and, you know, overeating and things like that. So, you know, it was a blessing in disguise, man, because, you know, you'd be surprised how many professional athletes have no clue about mental health and how it relates to their physical health, right? Mm-hmm. And so it was one of those aspects of things where, you know, it brought me to exactly where I needed to be. And I was able to, you know, teach about things I'd been through. And you'd be surprised how many kids, you know, my message, I started going around talking, speaking to children in elementary schools and middle schools, because you'd be surprised how many kids want to hear about the bad stuff, right? Everybody can't be Tim Tebow and, you know, do things perfectly through life. They want to hear about, hey, you were down there in the fire. Yeah. How did you get out? Because you'd be surprised how many, you know, 9 and 10 year olds feel like that now. It's super real.
It's more real. And when you look at the salad of shit that you went through, which one of those was the hardest to overcome for you? Was it reputation? Was it the loss of money? Was it loss of identity as an athlete? Which one was like, this one right here, Nick, that was the hardest one?
Probably the reputation. I believe a lot of people make decisions based on what others think of them. And it can cripple us sometimes, especially when it comes from your family, right? You know, I know a lot of people who are, I guess, pigeonholed by what their mom might think about this decision, or father. With me, you know, and that all went out of the window, because, you know, now my parents are having to explain to other people who know I'm in the NFL, like, what's wrong with your son, right? What, you know, so it was like secondary embarrassment. Like, I'm embarrassed because I embarrassed my parents. I'm embarrassed because I embarrassed my friends. So that level of accountability takes you to another level that a lot of people aren't willing to go. Like, yeah, this was all my fault. This was all my doing, but watch me bring it back now. And, you know, that was...
So watching the ripple effect of some of your decisions throughout parents, friends, et cetera, inspired you to take ownership, responsibility, and make drastic change.
There you go. It's only two ways to go, man, right? You can double down and say, hey, it was everybody else's fault, right? This was, y'all did this, right? You could have told me more times not to do this, but that doesn't get you anywhere. And I've seen that story happen plenty of times. Yeah. I didn't want to be that washed up athlete that's blaming everybody else for his downfall, right? And plus, you know, I was still young. I'm like, man, I can change this story right now. I can do whatever I want. And so this idea of taking drastic action, right? Me learning about people like Tony Robbins and Sadhguru, but, you know, these different elements of self-care, where you can be aggressive sometimes, but you can be vulnerable sometimes. It's okay to be hurt. It's okay to be, you know, it's okay to surrender, right? This alpha male mentality I had to get out of, because that's where we're at in NFL. You know, a lot of people look at that as the ultra masculine sport, and a lot of the ways we deal with issues and trauma is in that mindset too, which is not that healthy, you know, so.
Well, it's not that healthy mentally, emotionally, or physically.
None of the
above. Turns out it's not really smart to bang your head against another person's head at 30 miles per hour over and over and over again.
Really? You don't say.
It's just new breaking news. So we're gonna take this home. Tell us what you're up to now, what you've been up to, this recreation, this Phoenix Rising, this elevation. Give us the last 7 years, like where you're at today. It's really cool.
Yeah, thank you, man. Well, you know, I had two kids, my beautiful son, Sebastian, and my wonderful daughter, Cameron.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. I love them very much. And so they brought a lot of things into perspective for me, right? Who am I doing this for? What do I want them to remember me as, right? Because they could just get on Google and see what everybody said about dad, or I could present to them someone else. And so, you know, my children, they're a very big part of my life, but also learning about this holistic way of taking care of our bodies. So I started West Juice, all natural juice company, which started as a cold pressed drink. And then we migrated to a powder with 14 superfood ingredients. Shout out to my co-founder, Dr. Charlie Ware in Hollywood, Florida, who's an expert on epigenetics and all things health. And so, you know, this thing of getting people around me healthy body, healthy mind, because a lot of people don't understand that those things correlate. And so I took that into consideration, especially when it comes to the kids, because I was a very unhealthy kid. I had acne and all growing up, didn't realize the effect of sugar that was having on me, you know, things of that nature. So, I guess the biggest thing I took away from it is that I got to serve. You know, my duty is to serve. What's the use of going through all that pain and going through the fire if you're not going to serve others to make sure that they don't fall down the same rock? Because you'd be surprised how, I guess, how relatable football is to everything, or sports in general, right? Having to go out and prepare, game plan, and knowing your opponent, right? A lot of people don't even know who their opponent is, because, you know, some people haven't been in the sports realm. So really sharing my message and being a beacon of light has been my purpose. And I started working with Paulette Pfeiffer, a lovely woman here in South Florida, who runs a foundation by the name of Silent Victims of Crime. I've been working with them full time since about 5 years now, where we work with the children of incarcerated people. And, you know, that we try to stop that prison school to prison pipeline. And it's very effective, and it's affected me greatly over the past years, seeing these kids grow up and not go down the same route that maybe their parents have gone down, right, or to other people in their environment. Because
that was the group we got a chance to spend with a year ago.
Yes, sir, with Little Lighthouse. Yep. So shout out to Little Lighthouse too, and the great work you're doing in the community as well, man, because it's all hands on deck. It takes a village, man, and these kids, you know, it's not getting any easier for these kids on social media. With everything they're being shown and what's being driven down their throats. So we really got to provide a positive light for them to see, and to see people, hey, yeah, there have been mistakes that I've made, but this is how I came back from it, right? Not everything is perfect like you see it on Instagram. Everybody makes their life look so perfect on IG, and I like to own my mistakes as part of the testimony, right? Yeah. I want to hear about, like you said, in business.
Amen.
You lost it. How'd you get it back?
Amen. Yeah. So two top tips. Any direction you want to go, straight to camera. There's solopreneurs, there's entrepreneurs, there's sales professionals. Two top tips for them to fight through the fire and become great again. Hit them.
Okay, top tips.
Anything.
Okay, hey, if you're building anything, man, do it with joy. Do it with love. What the spirit that you put inside of it is probably what you're going to get out. And one of my favorite Bible quotes, Matthew 18:3, is that truly, I tell you, children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven if you do not return and become like little children. And so the concept of that, we need to think more childlike. You know, we need to start looking at things from a fresh scope and not be deterred by having a bad day, you know, making that a bad week and things like that. And I guess my second tip would be nothing in life is ever good or bad, but thinking makes it so. You know, Shakespeare said that once, and, you know, your perspective on life can affect everything. And far too often, we've almost been conditioned to look at things from a negative light, from a negative. We even talk to ourselves negatively. They say over 80% of our self-talk is negative. And so I want to tell people to think, start, you know, breathing and really living in the essence of positivity, even if you got to fake it till you make it, because it actually, it makes a difference, right? I guess, you know what they say, when you smile, your body, brain doesn't know if you're actually happy or if you're faking it. So, you know, hey, go for it.
Agreed. And where can they find you? Where can everybody find you?
Ah, you can
West
find,
Juice.
Yeah,
where
man.
Can find the West Juice.
You can find the West Juice. That's WESJOOSE. So once you Google it, you know, nobody spells juice like that. So that's why we went that route. But you can check me out on my website, wesley.com, WESLYE. Again, another name that's not spelled like that anywhere else. So, you know, we like to keep it pretty unique on this side. And of course, on Instagram and Twitter, Wes_Saunders88.
Beautiful, guys. Episode 23, Wesley Saunders, Forged by Fire. We had a beautiful story of, it felt like a lifetime of fire in a 4-year run of a shit salad of stuff this man went through. He overcame, he's rebranded, he's recreated. He's got businesses, he's a speaker, he's got children, and he's amazingly a beautiful human with a big heart. So I appreciate you. I'm grateful for you for being here. And episode 23, we're out.